Want to hear one of those odd little coincidences, or is it kind of moment? Here, I'll take you stage right here. Pull down the proscenium on Coast to Coast AM. So this is Ian Puttett going into our primary guest here for this evening, a book on power. We'll be talking with Professor Jeffrey Pfeffer in just a moment. Very interesting book on power. Who gets it? Who doesn't? Why you should have it, why you should fight for it, why some people may never have it. They can't have it. And the people that do have it that shouldn't. We'll talk about power. This is a powerful discussion. And I think one will be very eye-opening in just a moment. But to go back to my stated thesis, so we're just going into the top of the hour, and we're just about to talk about power when suddenly we lost all the power on the primary connection between our studios here in the upper Midwest, here right by America's Third Coast, and Los Angeles. All the power went down. I thought that was it was symbolic. We're fighting to keep the power up. We'll work it out. But why should you have power? And who has the power in your relationships? Are there some people that are disproportionately powerful? By all rights, they shouldn't be that powerful, but you're giving them the power over you. We'll talk about all of these aspects of power coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Potter. Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer is a professor and a writer. The book is Power. He's been studying it and he's been teaching about it for many years, mostly from a business school perspective. But the book is not limited to that, and that's why he's on Coast to Coast. Good evening, Dr. Pfeffer.
Good evening.
Let me tell you off the bat, I am a student of power, although I don't know that I am personally powerful. So I have been thinking about this subject for a very long time and wondering that if I ever really needed to have power, whether I would be willing to do the things that one has to do in order to make the right trade-offs to become powerful, which is why I really enjoyed how you laid out your book.
Well, thank you. And I think, by the way, the you raised two points. One is whether or not you have power. If you reach a large audience and can influence that audience, you certainly have power. And
They never pay any attention to what I'm saying
well, I don't
whatsoever.
believe that for a minute. And also you raised, I think, a very, very important point, which I'm sure we will touch on during the course of our time together, which is everybody thinks they want power. Everybody thinks they want success, but oftentimes they aren't willing to pay the price because there is a substantial price to having power. And I can certainly understand why some people would say, I'd rather not.
And yet the argument can be made, there's some people that really want it that can't do it. They will never be powerful. True?
Absolutely. I think, we often get in our own way and we're often our own worst enemy in many respects. And the thing that I think gets mostly in people's way in having power is that they say, well, I understand the game and I see what I have to do, but I'm not really willing to do it. It offends my sensibilities, or it offends my sense of what I ought to be doing, or it offends my sense of fair play, or all of these things. And it's like you look on the football field or whatever your favorite sport is, and you say, I want to play football, but I really don't want to put on the pads and hit hard. And you kind of doom yourself to either failure or to getting off the field. So yes, you have to be people do self-handicap and they get in their own way. There's no question about that.
You mean hitting hard like the Stanford Cardinal did this afternoon? You're talking about that kind of hitting hard?
Hitting hard, like doing what it takes. If you look
Yeah.
at the major political figures, or for that matter, the major business figures, but certainly the major political figures, who I suspect your listeners may know more, have more familiarity with. You want to be president, you want to be senator, you want to be governor. This is not, whatever the political office is, this is not easy. You have to be willing to, oftentimes do some things in your campaigning and say some things about your opponent that you may actually know is not true. You may actually have to, in the case of Meg Whitman here in California, spend a fortune, though, of course, for her, it's only a small part of her fortune. You
Right.
certainly have to You know, I have a dear friend, Steve Wesley, who ran and was successful running for state controller and then ran for the Democratic nomination for governor. And he's talked about having to go to all these breakfast, lunches, and dinners and have people ask you questions. And some of the people asking you questions have no clue about what they're talking about. And you have to be willing and happy to do that all the time. So,
well, then, and if in that situation, too, who truly has the power? If you have to go to all of these breakfasts and all these lunches, and you have to be engaged in conversations with people who don't really know what they're talking about, but it's something you have to do, then you are, it seems to me, you are powerless against that system. You don't have the power.
Well, Ian, you raise a fabulously interesting point. And the point is this: you can have power or you can have autonomy.
Yes.
But you probably can't have both. So, yes, you know, the governor of California has a lot of power, but they don't have autonomy. And you look at CEOs or these high power people or Barack Obama or your favorite politician, and you, in many instances, they don't even control their own schedule. I mean,
right.
they don't get to figure out who they get to have dinner with and if they get to go to a movie or not. Somebody else has done that for them. So you are certainly right. And that's one of the prices of power, the fact that you give up a lot of autonomy over your life.
Well, you know, there are a lot of people who like the trappings of power, and they think that having the accessories of power, like the latest cell phone, is an indication of how powerful they are, when in fact, I would argue, the most powerful people don't need cell phones.
That's completely correct. As a matter of fact, somebody the other day told me when I was giving a talk that the Japanese emperor has only his name on the business card. He does,
yep.
not only does he have a cell phone number, he doesn't even have an email address.
Yeah, I'm with you 100%. So we're talking about power tonight on Coast to Coast, but let's back up for a second and just define how you see power. I mean, how do you explain what power means?
Well, in the context, in your introduction to me, you know, is I think exactly appropriate, which is, you know, I've been at Stanford since 1979, so I teach students about power in a business, or not necessarily a business, because many of them go to work for nonprofits, but in an organizational context, and in an organizational setting, profit or nonprofit, there are a variety of people, each of whom may have his or her own beliefs about what the organization should be doing and what decisions ought to be made. And power is defined, in my opinion, as the ability to get your way in these contested decisions.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So that would, to get your way, though, how would you define the difference between power and influence?
So that's interesting. Some people see them as the same. I see power as a potential, and influence as power in use. So you can have power because of your position or your resources or your access to information or whatever, and then that's like a potential, and then if you decide to actually use it, that becomes influence.
Okay, because when we talk about power, political power, I heard a quote this week. I thought it was interesting, and I don't know how you feel about this, but that when they do personality profiles of politicians, what they discover is they have a dominant number of the same characteristics as the personality profiles they give serial killers. Ever heard that?
It wouldn't surprise me. There's a book out called The Productive Narcissist, and I'm not exactly sure about the serial killers, but I could believe it. But there's certainly a lot of similarity between somebody like Jim Jones, who, you know, led that catastrophe in Guyana where all the people drank the Kool-Aid. There's certainly a great similarity in his persuasive powers and his charisma and many of the politicians. And in fact, while before he went down to Guyana and left, you know, his followers with the People Temple, you know, and took them down there, he hung out with many politicians, very powerful people. And he had been encouraged, you know, he was a friend of many powerful people. They saw him as a charismatic and very a seductive leader. So there is certainly a very thin line oftentimes between, you know, productive narcissism and people who are psychopaths.
But and right there, the idea of being a narcissist means you elevate your self-worth above other people's to a degree that you feel like it's every time you speak, it's important. That when you make a decision, people should listen to it and abide by it. That you have a disproportionate perception of your value to society. And that's the same thing as a serial killer, that the serial killers dehumanize their victims. They aren't important because they aren't them. They are there. And I think that that's what a lot of politicians do, too.
Yep. And by the way, a lot of CEOs who will who laid off. As you know, over the last, you know, few years, you know, millions of people have been laid off. And I think, you know, in order to be able to do that and look at yourself in the mirror, you have to not think that the people you are laying off are anything other than economic units or factors of production. If you actually knew them as Ian and John and Mary and Sue, it would be much harder to say, okay, we're going to put you out on the street.
So we're talking about power. The book is Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. We'll get into some other questions coming up with Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, who's a professor at Stanford. Let me ask you about power as when it's held within, say, you know, in a local community where everybody looks up to an individual and voluntarily invest their sense of autonomy in that person, so that they're going to say he is a leader within the community, and he or she may find themselves having power that they may not have sought.
That's possible. I mean, I certainly understand the situation you're talking about, but I would argue that there are relatively few people who find themselves in positions that they have not sought, particularly positions of power. So I live in a very small community in California,
right?
And we have, we have a mayor and a city council, and it's nobody's even, we don't even have contested elections. It's kind of passed down kind of like a condominium association or something.
Right.
But in any event, you know, and I have known people, I know the vice mayor of our little town very, very well. And while it is true that people have looked to him and he's a wonderful person and is willing to devote time and effort to making the community a better place to live, he also has sought that position, because if you really, really don't want the position, you won't get it. So to take my career, you know, I understand this trade-off between power and autonomy very well, and I've kind of chosen autonomy. So when I was asked years ago by my dean to become an associate dean at Stanford, which of course puts you on the road to becoming who knows what, maybe a dean or a provost or
provost, right.
Whatever. You know, I understand, you know, there's a two-letter word which you can always say, which is no. So I would argue a little bit that the leaders in these positions have at least wanted them enough to not, when they were approached by their fellow citizens or whatever, and say, you know, we want you to take on this leadership role, they can always say no.
Okay. Well, I guess in some ways I was thinking of it in sort of a non-political sense. Let me retool that question and say, are people in Hollywood, the icons of every generation, the famous actors or actresses that wax wise and, you know, talk about what we should be doing and around the world or domestically, are they powerful?
Absolutely, to the extent that they become, as you just described them, and I think it's a nice word you used, icons, and to the extent that people invest in their celebrity, the idea that, you know, just because you're a great movie actress or actor or a great singer or writer or whatever, that you have wisdom that people ought to pay attention to. I mean, look at Lady Gaga, who since we don't have children, I don't know that much about her. But I do know that she has been very active on this issue of gay rights in the military and the don't ask, don't tell issue. And so she has tried and is, I think, is quite successful in taking her celebrity and using it to affect the social issue that she cares deeply about, which is, you know, fine, and it's a good thing to do. But my point is that, you know, yes, I think, you know, celebrities, not only celebrities, you know, you can think about the rich executives, John Corzine in New Jersey, and now Meg Whitman and Carly Fear Arena in California, and I'm sure there are a bunch of others who have taken their the wealth that they has been generated and the positions and the prominence that have been generated in the business world, and have tried to translate them that into a form of power and political influence. So yes, there's the power. Well, you can take power from one domain and try to use it in another.
And yet, in the case of Lady Gaga, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell failed. So does she really have any power at all?
Well, the question is, you know, it's like looking at, you know, it's looking at a car that's not going very fast. The question is, how fast would it not go if you hadn't, you know, done whatever you've done to, you know, put your foot on the accelerator? So I think she probably influenced some people, and, you know, and also.
But any of the people that actually voted, I mean, was there, I mean, let me say, I'll grant you that she influenced her fans. She might have influenced the curious. Who came by and stood there while she was doing this, you know, presentation in Maine, I think it was, and or talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell on TV. But did one senator or one congressman or anybody that actually had power, did one person change their vote because of Lady Gaga? That defines the power, I would think.
No, that's probably right. And she certainly, by my definition of power, on this particular issue, she certainly wasn't able to get her way, at least yet.
Right.
Therefore, I would say she's not as powerful as some other people, that's for sure.
Well, I think that's the difference. I think we naturally think of celebrities as powerful, but I think there are lots of times when people are overrated in terms of their influence. And I think that we, right? And I think
I think that's absolutely right. And for the celebrities, I mean, the interesting thing about celebrities, the question that I would ask is, who made them a celebrity? I mean, the people who are powerful, the people who are, you know, the people who are more powerful than Lady Gaga and all these other people whose names I mostly don't know, are the gatekeepers, the people that give them the access and give them and give them the attention and the media focus and all those other things. So, you know, I think if you to say to, you know, who's the most powerful person at, you know, Newsweek or Time or pick your favorite magazine or Bloomberg Businessweek, it's not the authors. It's the editors who provide the access. And without that access, you would have no platform whatsoever.
Okay. And so, to use your definition of power, Lady Gaga doesn't have the power to make herself famous. It's the gatekeepers. They're the ones with the real power. They're the ones who decide, you know, we're going to follow this woman this week. And, you know, so one gatekeeper sees what the other gatekeeper is doing. He doesn't want to get aced out, so he or she will include the picture in the story of Lady Gaga. And next thing you know, she's the beneficiary of the others who truly have the power.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I think, you know, anybody who's worked, and I have some friends who have worked in the media business and in the movie business, they will tell you that the people, I think the phrase is green light. I mean, the
right.
people who get the green light or not, red light, I guess is the opposite,
right.
A project, those are the real decision makers, absolutely.
Okay, so I wasn't intending to go here, but it makes me wonder, and as a business professor, you tell me what your experience or your interest level is in on this. But that brings me to all of the politicians' handlers, the people, the fundraisers, you know, the party chairmen out there who are really threatened right now by, say, the Tea Party, because they have their power system. They say, we will decide who our candidates are going to be. We will decide who will represent our party. And yet there's a bunch of people coming along going, oh, no, you won't. And so they're taking the power from the very power structure, and that may or may not work, but at least that's what they're doing. And then I want to ask you whether, from where you sit, who do you think are the most powerful people in the United States? And we'll hang on for that answer in just a minute. Jeffrey Pfeffer is the author of Power, Why Some People Have It and Others Don't. Why do you need power? What would power do for you? Well, it will add years to your life. Find out why coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, so Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer, who's a business professor at Stanford has written this book on power, which we're just getting into. You know, can you trust people who are powerful? What would you be willing to do to become powerful? Would you be willing to lie, even simple lies, even lies? You would risk a lie on something that would be verifiably untrue about you or about your resume. You might be surprised by what people will lie about to get power. Coming up, maybe you won't. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. I've always been interested in power. That's our discussion tonight, Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer on Coast to Coast. So I asked you before the break, who are the most powerful people in the United States?
Well, I would, it's an interesting list. I mean, you know, Fortune always runs these lists of the most powerful women, and then I guess they run some other lists of powerful people, and we love lists. I don't know how long the list would be, but I would certainly start with someone like Warren Buffett, who not only has a ton of money, and I think money often does correlate pretty well with power because money gives you the ability to do lots of other things and with it, and including, you know, fund your political campaigns and buy image and reputation and public relations and all kinds of other stuff. But also, if you look at Warren Buffett, whenever he testifies in front of Congress or whenever he speaks, people, including many senators on both sides of the aisle and representatives, pay enormous amounts of attention to him, because I think the theory is and the belief is if you've been that successful in making that much money, you must be really smart, and so people ought to pay attention to you. So I would, you know, start the list with people like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, who I think have enormous amounts of power. They draw large audiences wherever they go. People pay attention to them, and they certainly command the ability to influence public discussion. And Gates and Buffett, through their now their charity initiative, have actually apparently convinced a large number of their billionaire friends to donate a large portion like 50, of their
50%
money while they're even still alive to various charitable causes. So that suggests that the Gates and Buffett certainly have an enormous amount of power.
Okay, I'll go along with that to a point. And then I wonder how often what their batting average actually is for getting their way. If to go by your definition of power, how many times are either, you know, Gates or Warren Buffett rebuffed in their attempt to get their way?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'd have to, you know, I'd have to know more about what they've tried to do that they've,
they
you know, not
do
succeeded
right.
at. But they, you know, not everybody's going to get their way all the time. I would say that both of them have a pretty good batting average, and both of them certainly command the stage, the world stage, the national, you know, and the international stage in, I think, an amazing way. I think the Google people also have an enormous amount of power. Eric Schmidt, Sergey Brin, and Larry Page, again, in part because of their wealth, and again, and then also because of their leadership of an organization which is enormously influential in a variety of domains and in our life in a variety of different ways. So they, I would put also on that list.
You didn't mention the president or any president.
Well, you know, presidents, presidents don't have much ability to get their way without without the cooperation and of a lot of other people. And to, and in my opinion, and it is only my opinion, I'm certainly not a political scientist, there has been not many presidents since Lyndon Johnson who I think have been nearly as effective as he was in influencing, you know, the course of history and influencing the direction of the United States. So you see lots of presidents, you know, Richard Nixon, who I guess followed Lyndon Johnson, used to complain that he couldn't even get the bureaucracy to do what he wanted it to do, you know, and then there was Jimmy Carter. I think Ronald Reagan gets a lot of credit for being powerful, and he probably was. But many of the presidents are not very, you know, they come in with a variety of initiatives, conservative or liberal, it doesn't matter, and they're not really able to get those initiatives through, and they're not able to make really transformational changes. You look at Lyndon Johnson, you know, as somebody said in one of his biographies, like him or not like him, or like what he did or didn't like what he did, you know, it's taken many of the Republican, my Republican friends, you know, decades to try to undo what he put in place. I mean, he created enormous numbers of cabinet departments and federal agencies. He created Medicare. He created all kinds of things. And, you know, as again, like it or not like it, he was actually able to get a bunch of stuff done. And most presidents, I think, have not had nearly that level of success.
You were mentioned the word biography, and that reminds me that, as you point out in the book Power, a lot of it's about how who's telling your story and how you can control your own story. You may be an ineffective leader, but you happen to be really good at telling your story and getting your side of the events out so that even while you should have been out of a position of power a long time ago, people are sort of, they convince themselves that you'd better not be out of power because you are better than you really are when you actually look at what somebody has done on paper.
That is certainly true. But the only thing I would suggest is that, you know, a lot of people say, you know, I'm going to wait and build my public image and hire PR people when I become, you know, the CEO or president or something. And I would argue that you actually can do this and begin to build a positive image to get you into a good place very, very early in your career. And you, in fact, ought to. I think I tell in the book the story of this guy, Marcello, who's a Brazilian executive who became a CFO, and really he wasn't really qualified to be a CFO of a Brazilian company. He worked very hard to master the task. That was number one. Number two, he built a very effective network of other CFOs to get help and advice to help him do his job better. That was a very important thing to do. And the third thing he did in this company is that, you know, everybody says, you know, who wants to be bothered with talking to the press or writing articles or doing blogging or whatever? And he said, you know, that's not, the, you know, send the press to me. And so he took lots of phone calls, wrote lots of articles about lots of things, came to Stanford, where he got a degree in the Master of Science in Management, went back to Brazil, continued his strategy, and one day he finds himself on the cover, literally on the cover, of one of the leading Brazilian business magazines. And the title of the article in which he appears is 10 CEOs of the Future. So it's not surprising if you're listed as one of the 10 CEOs of the future, your future is going to come very soon. And he's now CEO right. of a large Brazilian company. And I think that really illustrates something which I've seen other junior level people do as well, which is you can begin to build a public persona and a good reputation, even from positions of relatively little power and relatively junior positions. And if your boss thinks you're like great because your boss is reading this in the media and everybody's telling your boss, wow, how wonderful Ian is, after a while, everybody will believe that and perception does become reality.
Well, and so that's that whole idea about manifesting your destiny. You can create a destiny for yourself. And that if you spend enough effective time convincing people of the truth of that, other people will cooperate in bringing that destiny to you, it would seem. It's kind of the same theory in a book called How to Make Luck. And it's kind of the same idea that you can get people through your own actions to give you what you want a lot of the time, as long as in exchange they're getting what they want too. And you can use this kind of influence, kind of a quid pro quo. The people that were writing the articles, that they were looking for a good edge for their article, and he happened to provide it.
Yep. So also the Brazilian journalists have the same problem as the U.S. journalists, which is, you know, the media is under financial stress, and they were looking for somebody, frankly, to help them do their job, and he was happy to help.
Right, and give them to be a cheap story. So all right. So, and you mentioned Meg Whitman earlier, and I promise you, I do not have a dog in this fight. I am not interested in getting into a discussion about California politics. But I do think it's curious that I had a friend who was working for Hewlett Packard when she was working there. He was kind of a mid-level, you know, guy. He wasn't too high up, but he wasn't at the bottom either. And he was just talking about what a terrible CEO she was.
You must be talking about Carly Fiorina.
Oh, Carly Fiorina. I'm sorry. Of course. Right. Okay. And that shows you how much I know. So, and that she was just awful. And that the fact that she was, that she couldn't get a, she just, you know, she couldn't get anything done. She was basically tossed out. When she left, he was like, oh, thank God, now we can get back to work. And that she had devastated the company with some decisions she had made, and that she was considered a failure as a CEO. And yet, as she's running for a senator, is she not playing off of, you know, the fact I was a CEO in the private sector, I know how to get things done. And I think, well, that speaks to controlling your own story to a big degree, doesn't it? And being able to get people to have a buy-in to you at the level you want them to buy into.
Absolutely. And there's a book out about, you know, the Hewlett-Packard saga, including the, you know, the spying on the board of directors and the Compaq merger, which got Walter Hewlett all upset. And, you know, then the book describes her as, you know, what she is, which is, you know, her background is in marketing. And the one thing you learn in marketing is you learn how to market. And the first thing you ought to market is, of course, yourself. And I don't blame her. And I don't think anybody ought to blame anybody for doing that. I mean, you know, everybody has a right and maybe even an obligation to tell their story as positively as possible and to put their best, in quotes, foot forward. And so she has, you know, certainly done that. You know, she's done that throughout her career. And she's doing that in this Senate race where she's running.
Okay. But I think that too goes back to how you tell your story is more important than how you lived your story. That if you can control the details about it, even just to use the Clintons as an example, I think they were masters of this. You find a way to use what power you have to criminalize your critics. That somehow that anytime anybody speaks against you, it becomes indicative of some other problem that they have, or you know, find a way to invalidate anybody actually giving you any kind of objective feedback. Then you'll be guaranteed to be able to survive anything, like he did. And I think that sort of still a lot of people still scratching their heads, going, how did he get out of that? How did he get out of that one?
It's interesting. Power becomes self-perpetuating. If you have, you know, if you are in a very powerful position, you control lots of resources, you control lots of people's jobs, there's not much profit to take you on. I mean, I may take you on and I may win, but maybe I won't. And so what's the point of that? It's much easier to say, you know, here's my friend Ian, and Ian's got, you know, control thousands of jobs and billions of dollars in contracts and, you know, business that that his organization or company is doing. And it's much better to, you know, to make friends with Ian and to figure out how I can, you know, benefit from that friendship and from that relationship rather than to take you on. And so you see, once people are in power, it's actually quite hard to unseat them. And it's quite hard to get, in quotes, the truth told, except for a relatively few journalists, of which there are fewer all the time, as the news organizations are cutting staff. You know, most people don't want to say, this is America, you know, and people don't want to hear bad news. And then part of the bad news they don't want to hear is they don't mostly want to hear nasty things about people in high-level positions of power. They want to, you know, what they want to hear kind of nice things. And so
I don't know about that. I don't know that I would agree with it. I think there's a lot of media organizations. I think there's a lot of successful shows on the left or the right that's based entirely on the contrivance of opinion, not on the gathering of facts, and it's not positive. It's almost like the more negative you can be, the harder you can knock somebody, the more respected you will be in your profession. And it doesn't have to be truth-based.
That I would agree with you. That's certainly true of politicians and maybe some other public officials. But I don't see that much with respect to CEOs.
Okay.
And if you actually think about governments, and this is true, Bill Moyers had a television program on this probably now, it must be 30 years ago, who talked about how the large corporations now really were more powerful than governments, because they span, you know, many countries. There are certainly organizations that have, you know, access to resources that would place them, you know, way ahead of many of smaller countries, and they, are able to buy a lot of influence, et cetera, et cetera. So corporations are enormously powerful in today's world. You know, I tell people all the time, we live in an organizational society. You will come into this world, unless you get delivered by a midwife at home, you will be delivered in a hospital, which is maybe a for-profit or a not-for-profit, but even the not-for-profits sometimes act like the for-profits if you look at their charitable donations.
Right.
And that is a large organization. And when you die, you're going to be buried maybe by some conglomerate that is running some kind of funeral service or something. And in between, we live, most of us, work for some large company. And so our lives are really under the control of these large organizations. And so, and I don't see much, critical attention being paid to the people running those organizations. But I certainly agree with you in the political realm, at least for some positions, we've gotten into this kind of interesting media frenzy. But
right.
but for many of the people, and then there are the invisible people, the gatekeepers that you and I were talking about earlier, who nobody even hardly knows who they are.
Well, I think that's, again, right. So how about for the political gatekeepers that we don't know who they are? Are there not those men and women, largely men, behind the scenes that are the kingmakers, and that they're the real people of power because they're the ones who will be, selecting who the next candidate will be for the party or how much money that candidate will receive? I mean, aren't the most powerful people in our culture people we don't know?
In many instances, I think that probably is true. But when you talk about gatekeepers, I learned a lesson from my friend, the late Jack Valenti, who was for 38 years the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. And the key to his success in running one of the most successful lobbying organizations was to cultivate relationships with the secretaries and the congressional staffs. That when you wanted to get in to see a congressperson or a senator, the person would make time, the person who controlled that schedule would make time on the calendar for you. And when and the bills, of course, are written more by the staffers than they are by the senators and congresspeople. And so he actually, I think, had a very good sense of who had the real power and cultivated these folks by being very polite to them, as he should have been, and being very, kind and deferential and always being polite, returning their phone calls very promptly within 24 hours, a habit that actually he learned when he was an aide to Lyndon Johnson.
What about these semi-secret organizations that meet, behind closed doors? They will cross party lines frequently. They'll be the groups that gather on an island and, the glitterati of any one particular party, the knowing ones will get together and talk about the future and they set an agenda. We hear about it. I mean, it's not a myth. I mean, whether or not they're as powerful as people think they are, we do know these organizations exist. Would they not be? The fact that we don't get to know what they talk about, and we don't get to know who they are completely, does that not also speak to true power, that they have the ability to essentially make themselves invisible?
Well, I don't think they're completely invisible, as you just, as you mentioned yourself. It is certainly the case that one of the ways in which people come to understand what they think, as a friend of mine once said, is you hear what you say. That's one way, and also I think there's a consensus that develops in these forums where people discuss issues. I think there's the Jackson Hole group, which is the Federal Reserve and the big economist people.
Right.
There's an Allen and Company group that deals with the media. There's Davos, the World Economic Forum. There are a bunch of these things, and I think it's not so much that anybody goes there and sits down and plots to take over the world, because most of the people who attend these things have already, in some sense, taken over the world. It is more that they go and they share information and they share perspectives with each other, and out of that discussion emerges a common understanding.
Okay, but that right there, you hit on it right there. I think that's, for the common person, though, they may be more affected by that than a multinational organization or a company that if there are people that meet, we'll talk about that coming up in just a minute. And I do want to get back to a very interesting point that Dr. Jeffrey Pfeffer makes about resumes coming up in just a second. And what happens to you if you don't have power? More on that next. The book is Power, Why Some People Have It, Others Don't, Why You May Never Be Able to Have Any, coming up next on Coast to Coast.